for today. So I'm going to lecture from a slightly different version, which means there's some irrelevant stuff I'm going to skip. So for the last three lectures, we're going to be talking about the interpretation of quantum mechanics. And there's kind of four, I call them the big four, the ones that everybody talks about. So there's the de Broglie-Bohm theory, that's what we're going to talk about today. Spontaneous collapse theories, I may say something about if we have time at the end, but probably because of the fact that I took too long to go through ontological models, we won't talk about that in class. But I will include my slides on that in today's lecture slides, so if you want to look at them on the Dropbox, you can. And then tomorrow we'll be talking about Everett, many worlds. And on Friday, we'll be talking about the sort of Copenhagenish type of option. So this table here, by the way, it's a fool's errand to try and completely classify the interpretations of quantum mechanics, because you'll always find some point that somebody thinks is very important that they differ on. But with respect to some particular questions, and so let's recall that's two of the important questions that we've been addressing in this course are whether we should have a realist interpretation or not, and also the status of the quantum state. So I've classified these interpretations by their views on that. Okay, so within the realist camp, the psi epistemic interpretations, well, there aren't any. There aren't any fully worked out psi epistemic interpretations that cover the whole of quantum mechanics, and the results that we talked about at the end of last week explain why it would be difficult to have that. So this area is probably ruled out. So most of the traditional psiontic models that fit in the ontological models framework, they just bite the bullet and they have a real wave function, they have non-locality and all of these kinds of stuff. If you want to avoid that, you have to posit some kind of more exotic ontology. And the main example of that is the Everett many worlds, which is of course also psiontic. But I have my own version of many worlds, which I call the ironic many worlds interpretation, which is actually psi epistemic, and I might talk a bit about that tomorrow. On the Copenhagenish side, I will talk on Friday a lot about this difference between objective and perspectival. So I'm not going to go into that today, but there are two sort of kinds of Copenhagenish interpretation, and I've listed some of the sort of modern ones here that'll be relevant to what we talk about on Friday. Okay, so let's talk about de Broglie-Bohm. So here's a bit of a history of de Broglie-Bohm theory. It was actually first discovered by de Broglie in the 1920s. If you look at the proceedings of the 1927 Solvay conference, that famous conference, de Broglie gives an outline of the theory there. However, he wasn't happy with the theory, partly because of these issues to do with entanglement and non-locality that he realized were there. So he kind of says, oh, here's a theory that works, but by the way, that can't possibly be right. And then he goes on to try and develop something that involves waves in three-dimensional space. So he didn't really take it too seriously. It was rediscovered in a different form by David Bohm in the 1950s, which is why it's sometimes called Bohmian mechanics. The forgotten first order form was rediscovered and promoted by John Bell in about the 1970s and 80s. Proponents of this interpretation still fight over whether it should be written as a first order theory or a second order theory. I'm going to follow Bell's approach here. I think it's the more common one. And actually, for both this and spontaneous collapse theories, I recommend this textbook. It's pretty good on these kind of realist interpretations. So if you want to know more. Okay, so remember, the goal of any interpretation is we've got to provide an ontology. They'll make a statement of what exists and how it behaves, and we want to do that in such a way that saves the phenomena. We want to explain the quantum predictions and our everyday experience in terms of the ontology. Of course, decoherence is going to play a role in our everyday experience. So people who advocate De Broglie-Bohm typically divide the ontology into two pieces. They have this idea of a primitive ontology. There are certain things that exist in the world that those are the things that we directly experience, okay? So primitive ontology is usually assumed to be localized in space-time, right? So the idea being, well, we observe, you know, chairs that are localized in space-time, for instance. If you want to be able to explain that, they say you better actually have things in your theory that are localized in space-time in some way. So Bell termed such things local beables, things that actually exist locally in space-time. So in De Broglie-Bohm theory, this is particles, the trajectories of particles in space-time. But that may not be the whole of the ontology. You may have a sort of higher order ontology, if you like, which is stuff that's needed to determine how the primitive ontology behaves. It's not, we're not supposed to think that, so in De Broglie-Bohm, this is the quantum state. We're not supposed to think that things are literally made of the quantum state. Things are made of the particles. The quantum state is there to determine how the particles move. Okay, so in a nutshell, on the next three slides, I'm just going to give you the theory and then we'll explain where it comes from. So let's just consider the simple case. We have a single particle in one dimension. Suppose it has no internal degrees of freedom like spin. Then we will use the wave function, just the position representation of the quantum state. That quantum state is going to obey the Schrodinger equation at all times. But we also have an actual particle which has position big X, right? That's the position of the particle, and we have to say how that evolves in time. Now De Broglie-Bohm, I'm giving the first order form of De Broglie-Bohm, so I just specify a velocity, the first derivative, first time derivative of that position obeys this equation, which is some complicated combination of the wave function, which I will explain where it comes from in a moment. But importantly, you evaluate this at the point X, at the point big X. Okay, so you take this whole combination, evaluate it at the point X, that gives you the velocity of the particle. All right, so so if we want to go to three dimensions, we introduce the configuration basis for three dimensions. Again, if we have no spin, then we use just the three-dimensional wave function. Again, we have the Schrodinger equation, and now the particle has a three-dimensional position vector, and we do the same thing, except we replace the derivative with just a grad operator, and we evaluate at that particular configuration, okay? And then it gets one level more, more abstract, okay? So bear in mind that I use an arrow to represent a vector in three-dimensional space. A vector in configuration space, which is the configuration of a whole bunch of particles, I'll denote in bold, right? So these are in dimension three, whereas the bold vectors are in dimension, I guess, six to the n, right? Oh no, it's three to the n because we're in configuration space. Okay, so to describe n particles, we need this position vector for each of them. We'll collect those together in this bold vector. That's what I just said. It's a configuration vector. Now we write a quantum state as a wave function on configuration space. Wave function obeys the Schrodinger equation. We also have an actual configuration. And the velocity of the kth particle is given by this formula, where you have to evaluate it at the actual configuration space point occupied by the system. All right, so that's how it works without spin. I'll explain how we incorporate spin later. Okay, so that's the whole theory pretty much, although there is one more postulate that comes into the theory. It's called the equilibrium hypothesis. So in order to obtain the same predictions as quantum theory, we need to add an additional hypothesis, which is that at time zero, at the beginning of our experiment, the probability density for the system occupying point Q is given by the quantum probabilities, right? So remember, here we have both the wave function is playing a role in determining the dynamics of the system, but we also have the particle positions themselves. we're free to independently set what is the initial probability for the particle to be somewhere. Okay, so let's set that to the quantum probabilities for now. What you can show is that under the de Broglie-Bohm evolution, under this evolution equation, if this holds at time zero, it will hold forever, right? So the probability density of the particles tracks the probability density that quantum mechanics assigns. This is called equivariance. It's a bit like, well, okay, it's called equivariance. It just means that the probability tracks the quantum probability at all times. Okay, we will prove that that holds in a little bit. But this is basically what's responsible for the theory reproducing the quantum predictions. So you have a configuration, probability distribution over configuration space, which tracks the quantum probability at all times. So there's some controversy about what this probability distribution could mean, because de Broglie-Bohm is supposed to apply to the whole universe. In principle, the whole universe has a wave function which is evolving in time. What do we mean by the probability when we apply it to the whole universe, which only has a single point in configuration space? Roughly speaking, at least as far as we're concerned today, just think that if you've prepared many systems in the same state psi, then the probability density of configurations, or roughly speaking, the relative frequency of configurations is given by this. That's fine for what we're going to do today. So as I said, quantum state is playing two independent roles here. One is it governs the dynamics via the guidance equation, and secondly, we use it to set the probability density. Those are independent things. Okay, this I'm going to skip. This was for undergraduates, right? I assume you know I'm going to skip all this. This was for undergraduates. Right, okay. So I assume you know this from undergraduate quantum mechanics. So now I'm going to explain where these equations of motion come from. So you know that in quantum mechanics, there is a continuity equation for probability, right? So this is the probability density, and this is the probability current. Probability current is given by this formula, and you proved in undergraduate quantum mechanics that it satisfies a continuity equation. So the probability current is sort of the rate of flow of probability out of a point x. And this is the 3D generalization, but the most general version is here. This is for multiple particles in three dimensions. We're working in configuration space. Now we have a continuity equation. So the rate of flow of particles out of a particular configuration space, the rate of flow of probability, rather. Okay, so we know this continuity equation holds in standard quantum mechanics. So this is how John Bell went about deriving the guidance equation. So we have the continuity equation. When you have a current, so if we go back to thinking about a flux of particles or something like that, so if you have a multi-particle system and there's a current flow of particles, the current is basically the net flow of particles. So if we have some surface area, there could be in a unit of time some particles going out of the surface and some particles going in the surface, and the current basically describes the net flow of particles, particles out minus particles in. But suppose we posit a theory where at each point in configuration space, the particle has a unique velocity. Okay, this is like in hydrodynamics, right? So if you consider the hydrodynamics of a river, we assume that there's a velocity field and particles basically have a unique velocity at any point in the river. Okay, so we're going to make a hydrodynamic type theory here and assume that the particles have, at any point in configuration space, there's a unique velocity. And that means that if that's the case, then the the current is literally describing the flow of particles. It's not particles in minus particles out, because particles are only going in one direction at any point, okay? So that's kind of like the hydrodynamic type of theory. So, so if you have many systems prepared in the state psi, then we want this J to be thought of as the flow of particle density in that case, right? So if we assume this is generated by a velocity field, it means that every point in configuration space has a unique velocity, then in that case, the current just has to be the probability density times the velocity, okay? So the equation for the velocity field should be the current density divided by, the current density divided by the probability density. And if we do that, that's the guidance equation. Okay, so that is where the guidance equation comes from. It's like we're considering a hydrodynamic type of theory, and we divide the current density divided by, the current density divided by the probability density. Now, this already proves that the theory is equivariant as well, because we know that the quantum probabilities satisfy this continuity equation. So if this is our current density, this will be our probability density at all times. This equation will hold. So if I set the velocity field like this, then this will be our current density by construction, and we will satisfy this equation, and therefore this will be the probability density at all times. So by setting up the theory in this way, it automatically satisfies equivariance. Any questions about that? Yes, no, maybe, okay. All right, so let's start looking at examples of how this works. So sometimes when we're sort of talking loosely about, and you know, we did this yesterday, sometimes we want to think of sort of Gaussian wave packets as representing a particle with a roughly definite position and momentum, right? So let's see what happens with a Gaussian wave packet. So here's a Gaussian wave packet at time zero. And if I set it up this way, it's got positive momentum, so it's going to move towards the right. So under the free particle evolution, the group velocity of this wave packet will just be this, dependent on the momentum. And it spreads out in time under free particle evolution. This is how the standard deviation in position goes in time. So now let's consider a time scale on which the spreading is negligible, right? So if t squared is a lot less than this, then this spreading will be basically negligible. Then what you can do is you can show that the de Broglie-Bohm velocity in this case is the group velocity of the wave packet. Okay, so you want to see that derivation of that's a little bit complicated, but this is an article where I think it's done really clearly, if you want to see that. So basically, if I consider a configuration which is located somewhere within this wave packet, if I'm considering the limit times for which it doesn't spread very much, then the particle simply gets dragged along with the wave packet as you would expect. Now you can also tell what happens if you're not in this limit. What happens there is that if the particle's right at the center of the wave packet, it goes along with this group velocity. If it's slightly ahead of the center, then it has a slightly faster velocity. And if it's slightly behind the center, it has a slightly slower velocity. And so the probability density of the particle spreads out in the same way as here. You can calculate that happens. Okay, so in de Broglie-Bohm theory, we think of a particle sort of moving along as its wave function is represented by a Gaussian, and the particle's just getting sort of dragged along by that wave function. Okay, so this is kind of a famous picture of the trajectories in the double slit experiment. Actually, you know, de Broglie-Bohm was proposed in 1952, and it was kind of ignored by almost everyone for a long time. And then in the 1970s and 1980s, we started to get computers. And so people could actually simulate Bohmian mechanics and come up with these kinds of pictures. And it was really like these kinds of simulations that led to a revival of interest in the theory. Okay, so this is a model where we imagine that our slits, so you know, you have an infinite potential here, and then there's sort of a Gaussian dip for each of these slits. That's the model that's being simulated here. Okay, so so what can you see here, right? So what we see is that if we go to the region where the wave functions don't overlap, the wave functions of the two slits don't really overlap, then the particles are more or less straight lines, as you would expect in geometrical optics. They're tracking the rays that you would have in geometrical optics. As soon as the wave functions start to overlap, we start to get these wiggles in the trajectories. They start to bunch together or space out, and that's responsible for the interference fringes we see. Okay, so if we write the wave function as a sum of the part of the wave function that came through slit B and the part that came through slit B prime, then when these things have no overlap, the probability current basically decomposes into, if we look at the formula for the probability current, I should go back to it here. If there's no overlap between the two components of the wave function, then this term basically splits into two parts, like one for particle one and one for component one of the wave function and one for component two. Right, so close to the slits, we can write it as just the current of the slit B part and the current of the slit B prime part. And the trajectories are just sort of as in geometric optics. Basically, the particles are being dragged along by those components of the wave function, just as they were here. But as soon as we get overlap, then we get cross terms. You're going to get a term in the interference and the probability current that's like psi B star grad psi B prime, right? So you're going to get a term across terms in the probability current. We get two cross terms, B against B prime and B prime against B, and those are causing the trajectories to interfere. And that's what gives the characteristic double slit pattern. Okay, how about measurements? Okay, so in order to handle measurements, so in de Broglie-Bohm theory, we imagine that there's just a wave function of the universe evolving in time. So we're going to divide the universe into a system and an environment, right? And this is going to allow, and there's a funny thing that happens here that you can't do in regular quantum mechanics. In regular quantum mechanics, if I divide the universe into system and environment, and I say, what's the state of the system? Then it's a mixed state usually, if I'm entangled. But in de Broglie-Bohm theory, the environment has an actual configuration space point. So I can define a quantum state, they call it the conditional quantum state, by taking the actual configuration space point of the environment and taking the inner product, the partial inner product of that state, of the quantum state corresponding to that, with the total state. This will give me a pure state of the system, which is the state that corresponds to this particular configuration space point of the environment. Okay, so generally these conditional quantum states aren't going to evolve according to the Schrodinger equation, but suppose my wave function has decohered into environment states which don't overlap in position. It's important here, as we'll see later, that the decoherence occurs in basically in the position basis, right? So what I mean here is that you know, I have psi one system times let's call it phi one environment plus phi two system phi two environment. So for regular decoherence, you want phi 1 by 2 to be approximately 0. But here it's important that it's in configuration space. So actually what we want is if I take the configuration space wave functions, that should be Q, but whatever. It's important that these don't overlap. So this overlap is approximately 0. There's no overlap in the position wave functions. So that will occur if it's the position of the environment that's causing the decoherence. Yeah, so if we do the sort of von Neumann measurement interaction where we couple to the momentum of a pointer particle, then two different states will get correlated with two different positions of the particles. Okay, so we're going to model our measurement device as a very large number of particles with outcomes represented by macroscopically distinct states and very small overlap in position. Okay, so imagine our pointer here is made of a lot of little particles, and the two environmental states are these two, where they're really pointing to different outcomes, and we can say that their overlap is approximately 0. Okay, so this is the evolution we're talking about. Right. The point is that when this happens, then the configuration of the environment is either in the support of this guy or in the support of that guy. If it's here, then we've got the 0 measurement outcome. And if it's here, then we've got the 1 measurement outcome. And then the conditional state of the system is either this guy or that guy. And then if you have that decoherence, you can also show that those two conditional states do basically obey the Schrodinger equation, because the interaction with the environment, the interaction with the other component of the wave function becomes negligible. This is probably what I've said here. Okay, so if the lack of overlap between these two persists in time, then the actual configuration of the environment is either in the support of this guy or that guy. By equivariance, it's in the support of this guy with probability mod alpha squared, and in that one with probability mod beta squared. That's just because we know that the configuration density satisfies the quantum principle. Then the conditional state will either be what you would expect for the collapsed state of the system. Each of these components evolves according to the Schrodinger equation, of course. Schrodinger equation is a linear equation. But importantly, the current breaks into two terms. And so the component of the current that's due to the zeroth component, to phi zero, is going to be 0 in the support of this guy and vice versa. There's no cross terms in the guidance equation because these environment wave functions don't overlap. And so therefore, we can effectively just use Bohmian mechanics for the system particle with the current according to one of the two collapsed wave functions. So we get an effective collapse of the system into either this component or that component. So you can use the corresponding current in the guidance equation to compute the subsequent evolution, and there will be no interference from the other component. This is because we end up decohering in configuration space. The environment states don't overlap in configuration space. All right, so here's another thing that's important. So suppose the measurement is approximately a position measurement, some kind of approximate position measurement. Then the two states that we've resolved of the system will have very little overlap in position, right? Because we're measuring that position, basically. Right, so in that case, the initial configuration of the system is either in the support of this guy or in the support of that guy with the appropriate probabilities. The measurement outcome then is just a deterministic function of QS. Basically, the position measurement, if we make a measurement of position in Bohmian mechanics, a direct measurement of position, you basically just read out the pre-existing position of the particle. However, if you measure a different observable, say momentum, if I measure momentum, then the collapsed wave functions do overlap in position space, right? So in fact, if it's really momentum, they'll be spread out over all of configuration space. So you can't say that the initial configuration of the particle either belongs to psi zero or psi one. They completely overlap in configuration space. And in that case, which measurement outcome occurs is a function not only of the configuration point of the system, but also the configuration point of the environment. Okay? The momentum measurement doesn't measure the de Broglie-Bohm momentum. Since I have a velocity field in de Broglie-Bohm, I can define a de Broglie-Bohm momentum, which is the momentum of these trajectories, but that doesn't correspond to a measurement of the usual momentum observable. Okay, this momentum is just a function of how the configuration of the system is moving, but actually in de Broglie-Bohm theory, a momentum measurement depends on the state of the environment as well. Okay, so the theory is always deterministic. The outcome of any measurement is uniquely determined if you know the ontic states of the system and the measuring device. But it's not what we've been calling outcome deterministic, because in an ontological model, we call something outcome deterministic when the outcome is uniquely determined by the ontic state of the system on its own. So de Broglie-Bohm theory, it effectively looks like measurements on the system, even if you know the position of the system, it effectively looks like measurements on the system are stochastic or genuinely non-deterministic because it depends on degrees of freedom in the measuring device. Okay, so the only measurement that just reveals a property of the particle is a position measurement, and when you measure anything else, you also depends on the environment, which again, you don't have full control of. Okay, so now about treatment of spin. There are a variety of ways to treat spin in Bohmian mechanics. The most common is sort of a minimalist approach where we just say, you know what, I'm not gonna add a spin degree of freedom to my ontology at all, right, to my primitive ontology. I'm just gonna have particle positions, and so spin only appears in the wave function, okay? So if I have, a spin a half particle, you can write a wave function including spin as a spinner. Okay, so if I have a spin a half particle, I can consider this tensor product of the position with the spin as a spinner vector, just track those two components. So if you have n spin a half particles, you'll have a 2n dimensional spinner vector. And then you just change the guidance equation to basically take the inner product over all of those spin degrees of freedom. So now I have an inner product of spinner vectors here as well. That's the only change we make. That's still gonna give you the derivation in terms of the probability current, so you'll still have equivariance. It is possible to have primitive ontic states for any complete orthonormal basis in quantum theory. But when you have a discrete basis, like as you would have in the case of spin, you need to have a stochastic guidance equation and the theory gets more complicated. So it's possible to do it, but this is, especially if you're really concerned about determinism, which I personally am not, but some people are, then this is the way to do it. Okay. So now in the remainder of, So that seems all fairly straightforward, right? You have particles that go along trajectories. Why would you not want to not like this theory? We're going to look at several counterintuitive features of these trajectories. They're features that violate your classical intuitions about trajectories. However, it's important to note that if decoherence occurs in an environmental basis that is localized in position, and that's important, as we'll see, de Broglie-Bohm trajectories will approximately follow classical trajectories. What we did yesterday basically implies that. Okay. So de Broglie-Bohm, in terms of an explanation of what we see, it doesn't really owe us anything more than that. It reproduces the appearances. So as long as we can get the Born rule, right, which we do, and we have that macroscopic systems typically go along classical trajectories, we're okay, the theory saves the phenomena. Okay, so since quantum and classical predictions are different, de Broglie-Bohm trajectories must differ from classical ones when we're in highly non-classical situations, right? You expect them to violate our intuition. The only question that we really care about is whether the trajectories are weirder than absolutely necessary, or whether they do things that are crazier than you think is absolutely necessary. Let's look at that. Now I have to go to a different lecture slides. What? No, thank you. Okay. Right, okay. So first of all, let's consider a situation where we have a stationary state, so an energy eigenstate. And let's suppose that it's a situation in which the eigenstate is real valued. Okay, so that would be the case, for example, in a square well, infinite square well potential. You just have a sine function, right? So the current is this. Which is going to be, well, if this imaginary part is going to be zero, right? So the current, right? Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the current, if we have a real valued function, so, okay, so the first thing to say is if we have any stationary state, then this is independent of time. If the stationary state is a real valued function, then this imaginary part is also zero, okay? So in that case, the particles are also stationary. So this applies, for example, to a particle in an infinite square well or a hydrogen atom. Okay, so classically, a particle in an infinite square well with energy En bounces backwards and forwards with this velocity. So your intuition is that we should have this velocity bouncing backwards and forwards. But what happens in Bohmian mechanics is you have this wave function and you have a particle which is just at one of these positions with the appropriate probabilities, and it stays there. Okay, so a lot of stationary states are really stationary. So that's a little bit weird. Most of the weird phenomena of Bohmian mechanics have to do with this thing, which is called the no-crossing rule. So in classical mechanics, you have as a consequence of Liouville's theorem, the trajectories in space, phase space do not cross unless you have singularities in your Hamiltonian, whatever. And this is because your equations are second order in position. So this QP contains the data needed to specify a unique trajectory, right? It's enough initial conditions. So if I have a point in phase space, then that point in phase space, if I know the Hamiltonian, leads to a unique trajectory. So there's no crossing of trajectories in space, phase space, because at each point, there's a unique place where it goes in the future. Now, de Broglie-Bohm is different. In de Broglie-Bohm, we have a first order equation, right? We got an equation for the velocity, and there's also no back action of the quantum. So we have two differential equations, the one for this quantum state and the guidance equation. But they're not coupled, right? Well, the wave function evolves in time and that affects the guidance equation, but the position of the particle doesn't have any back action on the quantum state, right? So if we consider two situations in which we have the same evolution of the quantum state, but two distinct particles, then because we have a first order equation, because we have a first order equation of motion, configuration, we can't have trajectories crossing in configuration space, right? So two different, same wave function evolution, two different configurations, so that specifies a unique trajectory. They cannot cross in configuration space. Now, note that when we have the measurement kind of decoherence, that's not true anymore, right? But we can't have crossing in the configuration space of the entire system. But when we have this decoherence, then the configuration space point of the environment is different for these two, right? So in that case, the phase space points of the system alone can cross, because they're associated with different environment configurations. And that you would need to recover classical trajectories because obviously, classically, you're allowed to cross in configuration space. Okay, but so let's consider situations where you have the same evolution, then you have this no crossing rule. And you can see how this works explicitly. One consequence of this is that, we call this empty waves steal the particle, right? So let's consider this situation. So you have a superposition of two wave packets. Let's say they're propagating in free space. Psi 1 is going to the right. Psi 2 is going to the left with some group velocity. Then the wave packets come together and interfere, and then they go their separate ways. Now, our intuition is that we have our intuition is that psi 1 and psi 2 are sort of separate components. Our intuition is that psi 1 go, psi 2, they interfere with each other, but that doesn't change the subsequent dynamics. So you might have thought that what happens is that if the particle is in psi 1, in the support of psi 1, then it just goes straight through. But actually, because there's no crossing in configuration space, that can't be the case. What it has to do is when it gets here, it has to turn around and go back the other way, because otherwise it would cross a trajectory of a particle coming in psi 2. So initially we have that this wave is occupied, this one's empty, and what happens when you have two waves interfering is that the empty wave steals the particle from the occupied one. So you can it's easy to explicitly see that in this situation the probability current is zero at x equals zero. Why? It's because this is basically an odd function of x. Let's see why. So we can write the probability current as a term that's due to psi 1, a term that's due to psi 2, and the cross terms, the two cross terms. Right, so here are those terms. But psi 2, 2 is just the same as psi, so psi 2, the evolution of psi 2 is the same as the evolution of psi 1, but flipped in x. The probability current for psi 2, 2 is just the same as the probability current for j 1, 1, just going in the opposite direction. And similarly here, if I flip 1 and 2, I flip the sign. So if I stick in x equals 0 here, all of this will cancel, right? So the current, and hence the velocity of the particle, is zero always at the origin here, even when I have these two interfering. Okay. All right. Right, now let's look at Mach-Zehnder interferometer. And let's consider a Mach-Zehnder interferometer here where I've taken out the second beam splitter. Now, most people would say that in this situation, if detector zero fires, then it's evidence that the particle went along this trajectory. And if this detector fires, then it's evidence that the particle went along that trajectory. But that's actually the opposite of what happens in Bohmian mechanics. So if I imagine that you know, these are governed by, so if I consider two trajectories, they can't cross in configuration space. So let's imagine that this experiment is done perfectly, and I can imagine that the trajectories are really down in this two-dimensional plane. The trajectories can't cross here, right? So if I come up here, I have to be going down to that detector. If I come up here, I have to be going up to that detector. And this is really, what's happening here is exactly what's happening here. If the particle's in the support of this wave, it comes and interferes with this wave, that steals the particle from it. Right, so, and vice versa. So the empty waves steal the particles when they cross. Okay, so detector zero clicks means the particle traveled along path one, which is bizarre, but of course you can't check whether the particle traveled along path one along the way, because that would introduce decoherence, which would spoil this effect.
So configuration space in this...
We only have one particle here, right? So when we have one particle, configuration space is real, is three-dimensional space.
The classical configuration space, P and Q.
No, that's phase space.
Oh, okay. We're just in
configuration space is Q, just Qs, just all the Qs, and phase space is Q and P, right? So it's so the bizarreness is, comes from the fact that we can't cross in configuration space. Mm-hmm. Classically, you can't cross in phase space, but you can cross in configuration space. Okay. All right. So this is there's something called surreal trajectories. And this basically has to do, this is basically just a sort of variation on this. See, the point is that you have to decohere, in order for decoherence to work in Bohmian mechanics, you have to have decoherence in the position basis. So you can place, say, a localized spin a half system in path zero, right? Let's put it initially in the spin up state. So, and let's have an interaction that when the particle, when the wave function by zero interacts with this, it flips the spin. We keep the position wave function of the measuring particle the same, but we flip the spin. And if we're in path one, then the spin doesn't get flipped. Okay, so the point is that the configuration of this sort of pointer variable is unaffected by the interaction. We just flip the spin, right? Current's still going to be zero in the interference region. So if we detect the particle at detector zero and subsequently then measure the spin, you'll find it spin down, right? So if you want to take this as evidence that the particle, so in standard quantum mechanics, you would take sort of measuring this spin as evidence that the particle was along path zero. So you might want to take this as evidence that the particle did travel along path zero, but in de Broglie-Bohm, the particle goes along path one. Yeah.
On the second line, it has psi one going to psi zero.
That should be psi one, sorry. This should be psi one here. This is supposed to be like a measurement interaction, okay? So it doesn't affect whether this system is psi zero or psi one, but it flips the spin if you're in the psi zero path. Okay, so basically, normally you would if you measure this spin subsequently and find it spin down, you would take that as evidence that the particle did travel along the zero path. And that will be correlated with the detector zero firing. But actually, in Bohmian mechanics, it's evidence that the particle traveled along the other trajectory. That's sometimes called a surreal. So if you want to view measurements which don't decohere, so by the way, I could have 500 of these spin particles and flip all of their spins and the same thing would happen, right? So if you want to say that should be a measurement, then it's not a good measurement in Bohmian mechanics. So sometimes people don't like that and they reject Bohmian mechanics on that basis. But I would say here, you expect the Bohmian trajectories to do weird things in quantum experiments. What about contextuality? Cochin-Specker contextuality occurs in de Broglie-Bohm theory because the outcome of an experiment depends on, in principle, all of these things, a lot of things it can depend on. It depends on the configuration point of the system, the wave function of the system, the configuration point of the environment, the wave function, the initial wave function of the environment, and the interaction Hamiltonian. All of these, it's very complicated in Bohmian mechanics, all of these things, how it doesn't just depend on what operator you're measuring. Different Hamiltonians can measure the same operator and they can lead to different trajectories in Bohmian mechanics. So it doesn't only depend on the ontic state of the system. So it does indeed depend on how you measure things. So here's an example. If we do a Stern-Gerlach measurement of this spin, right, this is the initial position wave packet, then how I orient the magnet will affect what the trajectories do because of the no crossing rule, right? So I need sort of to get a portion mod alpha squared of the trajectories going up and a portion mod beta squared going down. But because the trajectories can't cross, it can't be one of these trajectories that goes down, because that will cross one of these. So it has to be that sort of mod alpha, it's the upper portion of the wave of the trajectories and the upper portion of the wave function go here, and the lower portion go there. So if I flip the magnet around, I'm measuring the same measurement. I've just like now the down, now this direction is the mod alpha squared. But this trajectory here, let's see, this trajectory here that was a spin up indicating one becomes a spin down indicating one here. So the outcome of the measurement depends on how it's made. And that's actually much more contextual than implied by Cauchy and Speicher. Cauchy and Speicher, I can only prove contextuality for a three-dimensional or higher system. And here you get crazy things happening even for the most simple two-dimensional measurements. That's more contextual than it needs to be according to what we can prove in the no-go theorems. But that's basically the effect that's responsible for it. Okay. So there's also like a criticism of underdetermination. The only property of the guidance equation that we really need to reproduce the quantum predictions is this equivariance, right? So if you have the quantum probability, probability density at the initial time, then at the later time. Any other dynamics which is equivariant would do just as well, right? So if I take the, say, the quantum, the de Broglie-Bohm velocities, and I add this term, right? This term here is a divergence-free term. So when I plop it in the guidance equation, where I take grad J as part of the, when you pop it in the continuity equation, this is going to disappear because we take the grad of that. And so adding this to the velocity doesn't change the probability current at all. So you can add things, you know, so it's under, why does it have to be this velocity and not that velocity? Well, it's difficult to say. You could do other things too. You could add more primitive variables. For example, you could say, well, spin has to be represented by an actual physical variable as well as the position. That has to have stochastic dynamics, but that's okay. You could do Bohmian mechanics with a different basis. We could do all this in the momentum basis. You might think, well, how does that reproduce predictions? But you can actually make an argument that things are okay in the momentum basis. And you could even use a POVM, especially if we're allowing stochastic dynamics, right? So one sensible thing to do would be to formulate, to make a POVM out of coherent states and then formulate Bohmian mechanics on phase space instead of in configuration space. All these things could be done. So it's, I think personally, it's better to think of Bohmian mechanics like to not fixate on this one specific theory, but to think of it as a mechanism for converting some kind of privileged observable into a state of reality. Okay, so because for any observable in quantum mechanics, I can make a Bohm type theory in which that observable is the state of reality. Now let's think about also the equilibrium hypothesis. Quantum state, as I said, plays two roles. It appears in the guidance equation, and we set this as a postulate, the quantum equilibrium hypothesis. So you could say, well, what happens if I set the probability density to something else? Perhaps a uniform or something like that. Why wouldn't I do that? Now, the interesting thing is that there is evidence, it's still an ongoing project, but there's evidence, both analytic and numerical, that under suitable coarse graining, if I set some other probability density, it will relax to the quantum probability density, akin to what happens in equilibrium and statistical mechanics. So Anthony Valentini, in particular, is a proponent of the idea that these non-equilibrium states might have occurred in the early universe. Now, this would resolve some of the underdetermination, because if you could have non-quantum probability rules, then suddenly all these different possibilities would give different evolutions. So that would resolve the underdetermination issue at the expense of what most physicists consider to be bad things happening. Because, of course, there's at the ontological level, there's superluminal influences going on in de Broglie-Bohm theory. And if you allow yourself to set the probability density any way you like, you'll be able to see those as superluminal signals. It's only in the quantum equilibrium case where we wash out the ability to send signals superluminally. So it's kind of a bold hypothesis, but there you go. And here's some numerical evidence from a paper from a paper of Valentini's. So let's see. Let me try and remember what this is. Yeah. So here is the actual quantum. So this is some superposition of, I can't remember exactly what this system is, but I think it's a superposition of some energy states of an oscillator or something like that. This is the actual quantum probability density, what it's supposed to look like. And then if you put in some other probability density, then you can see how it evolves over time, and you see that you do actually get some kind of relaxation to the quantum probability densities. So that's an interesting hypothesis, which I think is worth pursuing. Okay, so then how about, so we've been talking all about non-relativistic quantum mechanics so far for de Broglie-Bohm, but there are versions of de Broglie-Bohm for QFT. They are in various states of completeness, I should say. But you have some choices to make, right? So if you're doing quantum field theory, should I posit that I have particles with definite positions, or should I posit that I have field configurations, right? So you could do it either way. If you have an ontology where you have particle occupation numbers, it's been shown that needs stochastic dynamics, but that's fine, that can be done. You could also have a mixture of the two. So a natural thing to do would be to say, okay, for fermions, I'm gonna have particles, because they, you know, most of what we consider to be matter in the classical limit is sort of made of fermions, neutrons, electrons, protons, and so forth. And we could have fields for bosons. Another possibility is you could just say, well, I'm only gonna have states of reality for the fermions, and I'm gonna treat the bosons like I treat the spin degree of freedom, or even vice versa, right? So all these have been investigated to some degree, and people argue about them. Obviously, these theories cannot be fundamentally Lorentz invariant because you have to formulate them on a preferred frame of reference, right? The dynamics, the influences of the wave function is instantaneous in configuration space, right? So when I formulate Bohmian mechanics in two different frames of reference, then I get different dynamics. Right, so there's a preferred frame of reference in which this dynamics occurs. So under the equilibrium hypothesis, the operational predictions are nonetheless Lorentz invariant because they agree with quantum mechanics, but the theories violate, what's called parameter independence. So if I make a change to a choice of measurement over here, then that can affect the configuration of some particle very far away from me. So that would become non-observable in non-equilibrium. Let's see, okay, so summary. So de Broglie-Bohm does give you a coherent ontology, it has straightforward equations of motion, and it saves the phenomena, reproduces the quantum predictions. The trajectories violate a lot of our common intuitions, but arguably trajectories are going to have to violate our common intuitions if they're gonna reproduce quantum phenomena. It's arguably more weird than it has to be. It's contextual in more ways than quantum mechanics needs. It's not non-local in experiments that actually have local explanations. For example, the de Broglie-Bohm explanation of the Elitzer-Weidman bomb is actually non-local. I didn't go through that, but it is. And it's psiontic even in for the experiments that we now have good psi epistemic explanations. If you take the equilibrium hypothesis as a postulate, there's no fundamental reason. If you think de Broglie-Bohm is the fundamental theory, there's no reason for taking that as a fundamental postulate. Why shouldn't I set the probability however I like? That leads to underdetermination of the theory. If I instead want to view it as emergent from the dynamics making it go towards equilibrium, that's better, I think, That's a more bold hypothesis, but it does lead to the idea that you're going to expect to see explicit Lorentzian violation somewhere in nature, wherever these non-equilibrium Bohmian systems live, perhaps in the early universe. So my view is that de Broglie-Bohm is a really good thing to learn because it's a straightforwardly realist interpretation that can reproduce the whole of at least non-relativistic quantum mechanics. And so when people make exaggerated claims about quantum mechanics, so for example, quantum mechanics shows that nature must be non-deterministic, for instance, then thinking about being able to think about clearly about de Broglie-Bohm is a good thing to do. I personally don't think it's a very realistic candidate because I would like to preserve Lorentz invariance or at least fundamental symmetries of nature in my ultimate theory, but that's my take on it. Other people are proponents of this theory. Okay, no time to talk about spontaneous collapse today, but I will include those slides on the Dropbox. So are there any more questions about de Broglie-Bohm? No? Okay, I shall see you tomorrow then.